So Beshalach. Doesn't really matter. I have a vivid memory, which actually ended up turning into a song. If you remind me sometime, I'll share it with you. But this was in 2000, summer 2000, Rosh Hashanah, and basically the world turned upside down for us. Second Intifada broke out. It didn't just break out, it was planned. That summer, Camp David Accords, Yasser Arafat, Bill Clinton, Ehud Barak, who was then the Prime Minister, and Israel basically offered the Palestinians, Arabs, 97% of Yehuda Veshomron, of the West Bank of Judea and Samaria, an additional 3% equivalent in land swaps in the Galil, a symbolic return of refugees, recognition of a Palestinian state, the whole nine yards, in return for Yasser Arafat deciding to commit that this would be the end of the conflict. And Bill Clinton negotiated the deal, and middle of the night, they thought it was a done deal. Like, if you think about it, the one that had the more difficult agreement to make was Ehud Barak. He was going to give up 97% of Yehuda Veshomron. He was going to get shechted. You could agree or disagree with his politics. Based on the demographics, it was pretty clear he wasn't going to get reelected. And he did it anyway. You can agree with him, disagree with him. It's easy, you know, sort of looking back at history to recognize what a difficult, complex, perhaps mistaken decision that was. But Arafat said no. And the Palestinians basically missed an opportunity, or once again didn't miss an opportunity, missed an opportunity. Bill Clinton would write in his memoirs that he was devastated and felt betrayed by Arafat. And a short while later, the Second Intifada broke out. By the way, Ehud Barak that summer also pulled down from Lebanon, pulled out of Lebanon unilaterally, which in retrospect was probably a mistake, at least in the way of the pullback. And over Rosh Hashanah, the Second Intifada broke out. Much later, they discovered, they raided the Mukatta, which is the was Arafat's compound in Ramallah, found all sorts of documents to demonstrate that these plans had been in process for at least a couple of years. Hang on a second. And got his driver's license. All right. So good to have you. So I'm going to get in trouble for that later, but I couldn't resist. Anyway, so all hell broke loose, and over Rosh Hashanah, shootings, bombings, gunfire on the roads, 5 people were killed, guns all over the territory. You know, when the first Intifada broke out, so it was mostly rocks and Molotov cocktails. The Second Intifada was 5 years after the Oslo exchanges began in 1995. There were 200,000 guns floating around Yehuda Veshomron, although the treaty was actually supposed to allow only 5,000 guns. So things went bananas. And basically, Matzei Rosh Hashanah, we found ourselves called up on an emergency draft order at Tzav Shmoneh. I had never had a Tzav Shmoneh before. Tzav Shmoneh is a special type of draft order where they basically call you up. I got a call, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning from my battalion commander, and he said, listen, we got a Tzav Shmoneh, we're being drafted. And I said, wow, when do we have to be there? He said, now. And I said, well, how long are we in for? He said, I have no idea. And imagine that we're in the middle. Imagine like we have plans, we're going to Poland, we're doing all these things. And then you get a call from the army. They say, nope, you're coming. And for the next 6 weeks, there's an army. Like everything gets put on hold. Your plans, your travel, your programming, everything gets put on hold. And we were basically defending a line around Beit Lechem, Chir Bet Aliyah, Artas, El Chadra, that whole area. And the most challenging part of this entire experience, I guess there were two. One was, we didn't expect that it was going to get so serious so fast. You know, you don't expect to kind of one day be giving a shiur and the next day being in a gun battle. But what made it really challenging was this was right next to my home. Like, we live in Efrat, and this was like a 10-minute drive from Efrat. It's a longer story than we have time for, but basically they decided that there needed to be special units in the Shtachim, in Yehuda v'Shomron, because when such a thing would happen, they wouldn't be able to get all the army in. This proved to be correct, and that's what happened. And I think what made this most difficult is you're right next to your family. Now, I had never thought about this before. Like, when I was in Milim, usually, you know, if you're up in Lebanon or you're in Gaza or whatever it might be, so you tell your family everything's fine. That's just what you do. When you get home, maybe you tell them a couple stories, but here you can't say you're fine because, you know, all your phones ring and you grab all your gear and you run out the door. The next thing they know, they hear bullets and, you know, they hear helicopters overhead. And since you're the Mempe, you're the company commander, they know you're in the thick of things. So this got really intense really fast. The second thing that was really weird about this was because it was right near Efrat, so you would go out, you'd get into a gun battle, but then you get a few hours in between patrols, you'd come home, catch up on emails, see the kids, then go out and do some fighting again. It was bizarre. And even though at first we thought that would make it easier, it actually made it much more difficult because you never made that mental switch. You weren't like in the army or at home, you were kind of both. And I have a vivid memory one night. I came back, I had a few hours, so I came like to tuck the kids into bed. And Yonatan at the time was 7. And I was tucking him into bed, you know, telling him a story, whatever. And had his arms around my neck, he's like hugging me. And then like, I gotta go. And he won't let go. I said, Yonatan, I gotta go. You know, Abba has to go, it's time to go to sleep. We said, Shema, whatever it is, will not let go of me. And finally, this is like, what, 17 years ago. He looks at me, he says, Abba, taftiach li shelo tamut. Promise me you're not gonna die. How do you answer that question? I had no idea what to say. How do you answer that question? And you sit here, like, you know, 20 years later. Only much, much later, we were in Florida on Shlichut, did I actually find out what had actually happened. He had, I don't know, been playing with or saw my shachpats, my flak vest, and there was a bullet hole, apparently, in the flak vest, so he told me much later. And I have no idea to this day if the bullet hole was from something that happened that week or just it was an old flak vest, it was an old bullet hole. But if you're a 7-year-old and you see your father's shachpats and it has a bullet hole in it, I guess that freaks you out. I guess you realize that there are no guarantees in life. And what do you say to a 7-year-old? And this is a conversation that goes on in Israel all the time. Are there guarantees? And why do I get to be sitting here when there are guys from that particular time who were buried 6 feet under an Herzl? Is it because you do something right? Is it because maybe Hashem had plans for you and maybe if you're still doing something right, that's why you're here? Or is it all random? Like, really? Do we really think that if we do the right things that we're guaranteed that it's all going to work out? Do we even begin to understand that? Does anybody here think that if you have a serious Yom Kippur, that you're guaranteed to have a good year? We all know people who are tzaddikim, or so it seems to us. I mean, I went to a shiva. I got home from the States on Tuesday night, and I went literally straight to a shiva of a really close friend, Stephen Essis. Really an unbelievable human being. Incredible person. Unbelievable chesed, midos, great guy. He was nifter from cancer a week ago. So does it make... And I guess the most difficult question, does what you do really make a difference? Like, we can sit here and talk. Some of us just had a discussion about the meaning of tefillin, the meaning of the Shema. You put on your tzitzit in the morning and you think about the nature of the mitzvah. You give a piece of tzedakah, whatever it is. Does it make a difference? Does the single action, you know, the Gemara says, tzedakah tatzil mimavet. That if you give tzedakah, if you do the right thing, it'll protect you from death. In fact, I have a vivid memory of walking from the central bus station to Yad Eliyahu, to this stadium in Tel Aviv. And that's where the staging ground, that's where all the buses used to go up north to Lebanon. And we would have to show up there Sunday morning, and you would walk there. And there were beggars who would sit on the street because they knew that soldiers were going to battle. and they would ask for tzedakah. Some of them were smart. They would say, tzedakah tatzil mimavet. Now you're walking back to your bus, to catch a bus up to Lebanon. You're going to be up there for the better part of 3 weeks. You have no idea if you're coming back. And some beggar says to you, give me some tzedakah, because the Talmud says tzedakah will save you from death. You give tzedakah. Like you're not, of course you're going to give tzedakah. But every person who gave tzedakah didn't. Like, that's ridiculous. So what do you do with that? So I want to share with you an idea from this week's parsha, which is hidden. There's a fascinating pasuk, right? This is the week of the most bombastic miracle in Jewish history. The Jewish people find themselves on the banks of the Red Sea. The Egyptians are behind them. They have nowhere to go. And you know, the rabbis, when they have fun, like, they have a field day with this. I mean, if the Egyptians are behind them and the sea is in front of them, it isn't just like the Egyptians trotting up the raging chariots and the barbaric Egyptians, and the spears are ready and the arrows are drawn and they're going to shech them. Hundreds of chariots. The mightiest military machine on earth at the time. And in front of them is the sea. And of course, the rabbis painted, it's not just a pond, it's a raging sea and waves 20 feet high. There's nowhere to go. Right? The Gemara, the Medrash compares it to a mouse trying to crawl desperately into the crevice of a rock to escape the talons of the hawk, only to discover that there's a viper coming out of the rock. There's nowhere to go. So Hashem, right, the Jewish people cry out, and Hashem says to Moshe, Mati tzakelai, what are you crying to me for? Debel b'nei Yisrael v'yisau. They have to go. And the whole paradigm, in the face of the inevitableness of life's challenges, Hashem wants us to do. So they do. Nachshon ben Aminadav, according to the Gemara, jumps into the water. Hashem, Moshe, the rod, the sea splits. Perfect timing. The Jewish people get through, the Egyptians come. Everybody knows the story. And then there's a pasuk. And this verse, it's so by the way that you kind of miss it. And pasuk says, it's in Perek Yudal, pasuk Lamed Aleph, it's the last verse before Az Yashir. Almost to suggest, this is why the Jewish people break out and say, right? Vayaminu b'Hashem v'Moshe avdo. When they see the greatness of what Hashem does, vayiru ha'am et Hashem, vayayisel te'adula she'asa Hashem v'Mitzrayim, the people see the great hand that Hashem stretched out against the Egyptians, vayiru ha'am et Hashem, and they fear or are in awe of Hashem, vayaminu b'Hashem v'Moshe avdo, and they believe. Ask me an obvious question. Ask me an obvious question. The sea splits, the Jewish people see it, and now they believe. Ask me an obvious question. Yeah. Now they believe? What? All of the Egyptians are showering in blood, and the Jewish people are drinking crystal clear water, and God doesn't run the world? Darkness seizes the land, but the Jewish people walk around in light. And God doesn't run the world. Every firstborn Egyptian, there is no record of any disease that affects people based on genetics or order of birth, rather. Only the firstborn and only the Egyptians. And they all drop dead at midnight. And Hashem doesn't run the world. And then, by the way, the Haggadah talks about how many miracles there were by the sea. The miracles you don't even think about. I mean, the odyssey of the miraculous was so incredible as to become normal. I'll give you an example. If I want to walk out of the Beit Midrash here and walk down to the Kotel, how long will it take me? 3 minutes. Let's give it 3 minutes if I'm thinking about a good thought. Now, if all of us together as a group of 50, 60 guys want to walk down to the Kotel, it'll take us more than 3 minutes, right? There's no logic to that, by the way. We should all get up and walk, and it should take the same amount of time, but it doesn't. You know how long it takes a group of 60 people to get down to the Kotel? It takes 10 minutes. That doesn't make any sense. It's mathematically incorrect, and it's true. You can check it out. Do you want to know how long it would take us if there were 1,000 of us? It would take a half an hour. Makes no sense. So imagine Okay? 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, and all of their children, and all the old, and all the young, millions of people, and they're getting out of Egypt. How do they get out in a day? That's a miracle. It's a miracle. And the number of miracles were beyond our comprehension. And they all just walk out of Egypt. The entire slave population just says, bye-bye, and they walk out of Egypt. And they still don't believe. How could it say, now, v'yaminu b'Hashem u'Moshe avdo? I'm putting aside the question of how Moshe relates to this. Okay? So, there's a fascinating detail that we find in the Midrash that Rashi quotes. Okay? And most of you have probably heard of this, maybe you learned of this in grade school, but it's kind of a great example of a fact that we're aware of that we don't quite know what to do with. So Rashi, the Rashbam, by the way, who is the grandson of Rashi, actually on this pasuk, he says, "Vayaminu b'Hashem, they believe in God. She'af b'midbar lo yamutu b'rav." He says there's a practical issue here. What the Jewish people believe all of a sudden is that they're not going to die of starvation in the desert. Now, why does seeing the sea split suddenly allow them? Like, if God can turn the Nile to blood and cause hail to be fire and rain together, then obviously Hashem can do anything. Why does the sea splitting, according to the Rashbam, grandson of Rashi, why does that give the Jewish people the confidence that they're not going to starve in the desert? Anybody know? Want to take a guess? What is the connection between those two details? Why does Rashbam say that? What do you think? Again, why is it that now that I see the sea split, v'yaminu b'Hashem, now I believe in God? In other words, we believe that God is not going to cause us to die of starvation.
Perhaps all the plagues show that you could take life for most people, but it doesn't show that you can save.
Oh, that's interesting. Except that all the Jews are sitting there. Do you want to say that up until now, God is destroying, but he's not saving? First of all, Hashem takes them all out of Egypt. That seems to be a salvation. Second of all, they all sit in their homes, and they're saved from whatever happens. And most probably some Jews stepped out of their homes, because we're Jews. Somebody's got to know, right? There's always somebody, right? And, you know, his mother, Jewish mother, is saying, "Don't go outside!" And he's like, "Ah!" Right? Okay. So, yeah? It's a good guess, though. Okay, that's an interesting possibility. Except if Hashem performed such a miracle as 10 plagues and takes them all out of Egypt, why would Hashem do all that just to have them die? Yeah?
I guess we need to go further with the fact that it was in a situation where they were literally like, it was this or die, and that Hashem chose that at that moment that they were going to live, and that even now when they're in the desert, now they get to live.
Okay, so maybe, right? Close to what you're saying, Moshe, maybe there's a moment. And we're so busy focusing on where the moment takes us, we don't stop to appreciate why we needed to have such a moment. Like, if God's going to split the sea, why doesn't God just split the sea? Why does God have them end up opposite the sea with the Egyptian army behind them? By the way, do you remember what causes the Egyptians to chase them? When did the Egyptians arrive? They don't arrive just at that moment. Anybody remember? They journey for 3 days, they get there, and they actually get there and it's nightfall. So what happens? Do you remember? I'm going to spare you because we don't have time to look up all the psukim. Anybody remember? Come on. Right? There's a pillar of fire, and the pillar of fire sprouts up. It's another big miracle, and stops the Egyptians. And so the Egyptians are on that side, and we're on this side, and they can't get to us. But now the Egyptians are chasing us. So if the Egyptians are chasing us, what must have happened to the pillar of fire? Hashem says, "Watch this." Right? And they start to advance. Stupid Egyptians. God makes a pillar of fire. You don't think you can bring it back? But all right. You hate that much. So Hashem is playing a game. What do you feel like as a Jew sitting there with the entire Egyptian army on some other side of a pillar of fire. You know, we kind of assume that everybody, that they know that all of this is God. Maybe it's not so clear. Maybe they're not yet on that level of belief. Maybe they're not sure if the Six-Day War is a miracle or if it's just a natural event. Maybe there's some gaseous explosion from the earth. So they're terrified. Why does Hashem do that? And then the Egyptian army rushes forward and they have nowhere to go. Why does Hashem create a scenario that suggests that there's nowhere to go? Why do the Jewish people need to experience that? I wonder if maybe that's what the Rashbam is saying. The Rashbam is saying, if you get to such a wall, then obviously there's no plan. Late din v'late dayan. There's no judge, and there's no justice. And Hashem didn't plan this, and this is all a big mistake. And you see how often they go back to Moshe with complaints, and we're all going to be destroyed. The splitting of the sea is not just that they get saved. The splitting of the sea is that it was all part of a plan. And it's interesting that the Jewish people need to experience a moment of pure despair. They need to feel it's all over. It's like a woman just before the baby is born and labor gets worse. It's the darkness before the light. And I guess one might suggest that the Jewish people need to experience that there's no way out so that they can learn that when you think there's no way out, there's always a way out. I once shared with you the idea from the Eish Kodesh, right? Clonimus Kalman Shapiro, one of the last rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto. Clonimus Kalman Shapiro says, as Sinaites in his drasha before Shavuot in the Warsaw Ghetto, talk about a time when it looked like there was no way out. He says, the verse says, I lift up my eyes to the mountains. From whence comes my salvation? My salvation comes from God, creator of the heavens and the earth. So asks the Eish Kodesh, why does God need a resume? Like if I know that my salvation comes from God, then obviously I know Hashem creates the heavens and the earth. Why does it have to say my salvation comes from God, who creates the heavens and the earth? He says an unbelievable thing. He says, you know, there are times in life when you find yourself in a tough spot, but you know what has to happen to get out. You know what has to happen. You're driving your car, you don't notice the red light, all of a sudden you're going through the crossroads, there's a truck coming, you know what has to happen. You just hit your brake, and you just hope that the brake's going to work and it's going to stop in time. You have a clear imagination of what is going to happen, what needs to happen for you to be saved. Right? But then there are times where you get yourself into a tough spot and you can't imagine how you'd be saved. Right? You're leaning against the door of a plane at 30,000 feet and something goes wrong and it accidentally opens and you fall out. There's no parachute. You're falling out at 30,000 feet over the Rockies. Like, what are you going to dive for? Wings? It's over. Says the Eish Kodesh, when you have a moment like that, just remember who you're praying to. You're talking to Hashem who created, Hashem created planes, and Hashem created gravity, and Hashem created the Rocky Mountains, and if Hashem wants you to survive, you'll survive. And there are cases like that. And that's this moment. The Jewish people are in a moment where there's no way out. The pattern is being set for Jewish history. When the Jewish people are in a moment where there's no way out, know that there's always a way out. We should not be here. We shouldn't have been here in 1945. We shouldn't have been here in 1948. We shouldn't have been here in 1967. We shouldn't have been here in 1973. The list just goes on and on. And all of a sudden the Jewish people discover that it's all part of a plan. So Hashem has it all planned. He set the Egyptians up. We were meant to be delivered. It's all going to work out. So how come now they believe? So Rashi quotes the Medrash. And if you look at the Psukim, when the Torah describes in the Song of the Sea that the Egyptians are drowning, it actually uses three very distinct terminologies to describe them drowning. Okay? First it says, in Pasuk Hey, this is all in Perek Tevav, the 15th chapter of B'Shalach of Shemot, they sank in the waves like stones. They were like a stone when they drowned. And then the pasuk says, Yochalemo kakash, they'll be destroyed like straw. And then it says further in pasuk Yud, Kaoferet. Right? Salalu Kaoferet b'mayim adirim. They sank like lead. So which was it? Did they sink like straw, like stone, or like lead? So Rashi quotes the Medrash, and the Medrash is like this. Ubimakom acher tzalu kaoferet. Why does it say in these different terminologies? Ubimakom acher yocholem kakash, and like straw. Harishain kakash, holchim umtafin olim v'yodin. The really wicked ones, they didn't get to drown right away. And a piece of straw doesn't drown right away. It floats around the water until it gets so waterlogged it finally sinks. Their suffering was prolonged. Their death took longer. Beinonim ka'evin. And the ones who weren't super tzaddikim, but they weren't so bad, they were like rocks. And a rock sinks slowly. Beinonim ka'evin. Ve'aksherim. But the ones who were kasher, who were better, who were compassionate, even as Egyptian taskmasters, ka'oferet shenachu miyad. They were like lead. They sank right away. So says the Chafetz Chaim, our friend, in one of his shiurim, quotes the Chafetz Chaim, amazing idea. Just think about it. Jewish people are watching the Egyptians drown. If you're a survivor of Treblinka, and you see Ivan the Terrible across the train platform, you know exactly who he is. If you survived Auschwitz, and you see Eichmann from a distance, you know exactly who he is. It's a face, it's ingrained in your memory. My brother-in-law's father-in-law is a survivor of a number of camps, including Auschwitz, and he saw Eichmann. And his face will be in his brain until the day he dies. You don't forget that. So there's no reason to assume it was different back then. The Jews are seeing that the Egyptian taskmasters, who were horrendously cruel, they were suffering more. And the ones who were at least compassionate, they all have to die, but they died differently. So what message did Jewish people take away from that? Basically, that what you do makes a difference. Think about this for a second. The plagues in Egypt are national events. Everybody suffers or everybody is saved. There is no difference between the compassionate Egyptian and the cruel Egyptian. And there was no difference between the Jew who believed and the Jew who believed less. Everybody got to drink water. Everybody didn't have frogs, and everybody didn't have lice. It was all one big party. So on a national, macro level, Hashem runs the world. But just because Hashem runs the world doesn't mean that what I do makes a difference. Hashem promises that one day the Jewish people will come home. For hundreds of years, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, prophets were saying, there will come a day when the Jewish people come home. But there's no guarantee that I'm going to be there. Maybe it's random whether I get there or not. Maybe what I do doesn't really make a difference. Vayaminu b'Hashem of Moshe Avdo, they suddenly believe. Their belief takes a different level because they suddenly realize that what every individual does, every individual action, actually makes a difference. And by the way, that's the secret of relationships. Taking a relationship to a different level is when you're able to demonstrate to another person that what they do really matters. You know, your kid comes home, and he's 3 years old, and he drew a drawing, and he's so excited, and he brings home the drawing. And you're so excited because he drew a drawing. You don't know what it is, you don't know, and you put it on the fridge. This is a true story. You put it on the fridge. This is in your honor. You put it on the fridge, and like, look at the drawing. And he starts crying. And he gets really angry because you hung it upside down. It's a whole bunch of lines. It all looks right side up or upside down to you. And he says, it's upside down. So what do? You got two choices. You could say, dude, it's okay, it's up on the fridge. Or you do what any healthy parent does. And you say, wow, I'm so sorry. And you turn it over. And then your wife walks in and she goes, that looks much better. And what you're basically saying is, it matters. And you matter. And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes, you know, kid walks into your life and he's having difficulty with the homework, right? And, you know, I'm not going to be home on time for dinner. The babysitter will take care of it. So the homework may get done. But does he really matter? To the degree that we're able to demonstrate that the things that people do make a difference to us, to the degree that we believe that the things we do make a difference, that's where faith begins. And that's how you create faith in relationships. And I think maybe that's what the Jewish people were ready to experience. They were finally ready to believe. Because think about it, when you're in Egypt as a slave, that's the definition of slavery. You don't really matter. And you get out of Egypt, and all of a sudden, you actually matter. You know, historians believe that for the Western world, one of ancient Egypt's creations was numbers. The numeric system was created by the Egyptians. Do you know why they created a numeric system? Because they were a caste society. They needed a way to identify how many slaves they had. So they were the first society that turned human beings into numbers. And we lived and rediscovered the reality of what it means to turn a human being into numbers. The Jewish people have a mitzvah that you're not allowed to count. You don't count human beings because a human being is not a number. So at the beginning of our journey, as we go through the sea and it splits, and allegorically the Jewish people are walking through the mikveh, and as they're doing that, they're in the process of discovering that every human being matters, and everything every human being does matter, and what a Rasha does matter, and what a Tzaddik does matter, the whole thing matters. Every wicked action, every righteous action, everything you do. And that's the secret of B'Shalach. So there's a lot more to talk about, but we're ready for a little Chadar Choshech. Questions? Do you have any questions? By the way, just to finish this off, that is what some of us were talking about this week. That is exactly what the second parsha of Vayayim Shemoah is all about. The second portion of the Shema, Vayayim Shemoah, is if you will listen to me, then you will be rewarded, and if you don't, then v'charaf Hashem b'chem, which means there's a consequence to what you do. The second part of Shema is that what we do has meaning, and therefore we're meaningful. You want to ask something?
Speak up.
What?
I know there's a machloket of whether or not Israel believes from the second time or from Har Sinai. As a rabbi, we deal with the fact that the Amin
right. So the Chafetz Chaim would say that there are different levels of belief. Right? And emunah is not the same as ri'iyah. Ri'iyah is a concretization, to see something. Right? When they say seeing is believing, what that means is that there's a level of belief that comes from seeing that you don't yet have until you get there. So that's how the Chafetz Chaim would look at it, that there are different levels of belief. Right? And they're not there yet. You could ask that question in a different way, and you could say, so if they believe already, why do they still need Har Sinai? Right? By the way, there is another way to look at this, which is, if you look at the beginning of the Ten Commandments in next week's Parsha, so it says, what's the first word of the Ten Commandments? Anochi, right? I am the Lord your God. That's what everybody would say. And everybody would be wrong. Because the first word of the Ten Commandments is actually, Ela Dvarim, Asher Diber Hashem, El Bnei Yisrael Lemor. These are the things, the words that Hashem spoke to Jewish people saying, and then you start thinking about it. Right? So one of the commentaries, Hananya Kaziz, the Kina Sofrim, and the Rambam, asks, why does it say Lemor? Why does it say, Eilat Varim Hashem Diber Hashem? These are the things that Hashem said to the Jewish people saying. Now, when you find that verse that's commonly appears in the Torah, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, what it means is Hashem is speaking to Moshe, and Moshe is supposed to repeat it, he's supposed to say it. Hashem is saying it to Moshe in order that Moshe says it to the Jewish people. But in this instance, Hashem's already talking to the Jewish people. The first two commandments, supposedly, were given by God directly to the Jewish people. So why is it say Lemor? Somebody give me an obvious answer. Because the Jewish people were meant to pass it on. So what happens at Har Sinai is that that's the experience that isn't just about where I am to pull me out of Egypt. That's the experience that's meant to solidify our faith and our future for generations to come. Every generation doesn't get to experience Har Sinai. There was only one Mount Sinai revelation. But that revelation was so powerful that 3,200 years later, we're still accepting it. We're still living it. We're still studying it. We're still teaching it. So it must have been a pretty powerful message. So, food for thought. Bezrat Hashem, we should find the ability within the context of those walls we sometimes face when we think in life sometimes, and we will all reach those spots and think that there's no way out, and know that there's always a way out. There's always a way out. And what we do matters. Everything from the big pieces to the little piece. Right? You walk into the Beit Midrash and there's a book there, and it belongs to somebody, and you return it to them. That's a significant act. You come into the dorm at night and you're quiet and you let somebody sleep. That's a significant act. And it makes a difference. And it changes the world.